I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Mara B. Gad, author of the new book, The Color of Love, a story of a mixed-race Jewish girl. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. Or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. My Bubby Irma, who died at the age of 100 after a long and incredibly productive life, had a sign in her office that read, "The Chinese word for crisis contains two characters. One of them means opportunity." That sign now sits in my own office. I have thought of that quotation often of late, for we have surely had an extreme experience of crisis in recent months here in Tucson, Arizona, where I live, whipsawed from crisis to crisis, seemingly. The coronavirus public health crisis led to lockdown, which led to economic crisis, which led us to open things up, which led to another COVID-19 crisis, in which our state suddenly leads the nation in a bad way. My father, Rabbi Baruch Kohan, is a mere 94 years old. Yesterday, he said, "I've never seen an international health crisis like this in my lifetime." Well, this should be crisis enough for one period of time, and we are certainly not done with it yet. But wait, there's much more. The Minneapolis police's murder of George Floyd in May shined a fierce light on our national shame of racism and police brutality to people of color. That crisis rapidly transformed into a genuine protest movement of a scope we haven't seen since the early 1970s. Right here in Tucson, an active and highly energetic, peaceful movement evolved from the initial angry response, a truly diverse and broad-based assembly of people protesting systemic racism and problematic police process. And then the Bighorn wildfire here locally charred its way into our lives, forcing emergency evacuations of people and animals to avoid a fierce wildfire. Another crisis. All of this is proof, if we need it, that we are not prophets, my friends. Turn the clock back to January, you won't find a single soul predicting the nonstop flow of crises we find ourselves floundering in. All of which calls to mind our greatest leader, Moses, and his predicament in the Sinai wilderness and the Torah portions we're reading in the synagogue right now. Just when Moses thinks he's succeeded in schlepping the Israelites to the Promised Land, just when his difficult, crisis-filled journey from Mount Sinai to the land of Israel has finally succeeded, he runs smack dab into the most terrible crisis yet. Mind you, our Israelite people has been stiff-necked and difficult to lead from the beginning, prone to kvetch and mutiny at the smallest provocation, complaining and rebelling all the way from the shores of the Red Sea to the boundaries of Canaan. But against all odds and through crisis after crisis, Moses has managed to drag the Israelites to the very border of the Promised Land. And after he sends 12 scouts to spy out the land, he anticipates leading the people of Israel in a triumphant conquest of their new country, you know, Israel. Only it goes wrong again. While 12 spies, all of them, say the land is good, flowing with milk and honey, you've heard the phrase, 10 of them say that there is no way to defeat the residents and capture the country. Hearing this, the people of Israel, of course, immediately assume disaster is the only possible outcome. This crisis will not be overcome in the ordinary ways. You know those two Chinese characters, danger and opportunity for crisis? Well, the Israelites, the ancient Jews, always seem to fixate on the first of those meanings. They view each crisis as a terrible danger. They never notice the opportunity. The Israelites' confused response, "Lead us back to Egypt." "No, never mind. We'll invade and fight without you, Moses," leads to disaster. The end result of this crisis is the Israelites must now wait for 38 years until this entire fractious generation will die out in the desert, and a younger group, without the stain of slavery, can conquer the land. Moses, their fearless leader, is faced with a dreary wait for the death of his entire people. And even he, ultimately, won't be allowed to enter Israel. It's a sad and disastrous response to crisis, all because the people of that day could only seek danger in crisis, not opportunity. As we struggle now with our own series of crises in these complex times, we need to be aware of the terrible dangers we face. As responsible adults, we must do what we must to protect everyone from those dangers. But we also need to be cognizant of the opportunities that are presented. We can seize this chance to be a new generation that embraces positive change. We can refuse to accept our current unhealthy society, riddled as it is with racism, and the reality that we are a nation that cannot cope with a public health crisis or conduct law enforcement without bias. We can use this opportunity to change society for the better. On the one hand, we can create new standards for policing, not eliminating our police forces, of course, but choosing to reconstruct them without the obvious biases, racism, brutality, and cover-ups that exist now. And we can efficiently remake our deeply flawed public health system, prepare it properly for future pandemics, make quality care available to everyone for a reasonable price, provide centralized, honest, scientific solutions for our whole nation. Or we can just wander lost in the desert for another 38 years and wait for another generation to solve the problems we have failed to face until now. I hope and pray that we recognize in these crises the opportunity to change, that we decide to seize that opportunity and act. Then perhaps we will be permitted to enter our own promised land. To play us in this morning, here's a classic Arik Einstein song from an era when we believed we could change the world. I think it needs changing now quite as much as it did back then. Ani ve'ata nishaneh et ha'olam. You and I can change the world.
Ani ve'ata nishaneh et ha'olam. Ani ve'ata az yavohu kvar kulam. אמרו את זה קודם לפניי, לא משנה. אני ואתה משנה את העולם. אני ואתה ננסה בהתחלה. יהיה לנו רע, לא נורא. אמרו את זה קודם לפניי, זה לא משנה. אני ואתה משנה את העולם.
That was the late Arik Einstein's timeless message, "You and I can change the world, if we choose to do so." When we return in a moment here on Too Jewish, Mara B. Gad, the author of the new book, The Color of Love, a story of a mixed-race Jewish girl, will explain what it's like to grow up Jewish and black, and just how much racism exists in aspects of the Jewish community that we think are truly colorblind. Find out and return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates an array of services, classes, and events this summer. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vital, vibrant community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the entire metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha's synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone in normal times. In these days of coronavirus tsuris, join us Friday night on our Facebook page every Friday night. Shabbat evening celebration services are at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning Shabbat services are at 10 a.m. On Facebook, the page is Beit Simcha Tucson, Beit Simcha Tucson. We'll have our services with full music by virtual experience weekly for the time being. Our Adult Education Academy classes are on Zoom. You can access all of it by emailing me at rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org, rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. Synagogue is at 2270 West Ina Road, west of La Cholla, on the north side of Ina, at the entrance to the Foothills Mall property, not in the mall, but on the south side in our own building. For now, we are a fully functioning virtual congregation on Zoom and Facebook. Email us at board@beitsimchatucson.org or rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org for more information. To learn about Congregation Beit Simcha, to attend services, right now, led by my father, Rabbi Baruch Kohan, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, and, of course, all of our services on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. Or www.BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, at the fastest-growing synagogue and newest Jewish community in southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning, Mara Begad's new book is called The Color of Love, Diary of a Mixed-Race Jewish Girl. It's a really interesting and I think in some ways challenging book. She has quite a career, and I'll let her tell you about that. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me, Rabbi.
So you have a successful career arranging funding for films and doing a variety of important things. What prompted you to write The Color of Love right now?
It was a number of things. One, I believe societally that there was finally a window where I could speak the truth about what it has been like to be biracial and Jewish for the last 50 years. And I would also offer that I was finally in a place where I felt like I had the voice to say what I wanted to say. And so it was the perfect moment for me to speak.
So in your book, you chronicle a variety of times when members of your own family, in particular one relative, treated you as an alien. Your parents at times had to confront them directly. How common do you think that sort of attitude, that sort of, I don't know, hidden racism might be the right way to put it, is prevalent in Jewish families today?
I don't know, first of all, that I would call it hidden. I think any time a word like Shvarta is spoken openly in a home, not exactly hidden, right?
Right, for sure.
I would say, it's very hard to speak for other people and other people's families. But what I know to be true about racism and intolerance is that it is a natural human condition. For as long as there have been human beings populating the planet, there has been one telling another or a group telling another group, you are less than me because you're different from me, and you don't deserve to be treated with respect, you don't deserve rights, you don't deserve to live. It's happening 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I mean, look at George Floyd.
Yeah, horrific.
And what took place, you know, black men are being killed in the streets. And so do I believe that it is still happening in Jewish families today? I do. I wish that I could say that I don't, but I do.
When did you first experience, say, in religious school, the sense that, although here you were, a nice little Jewish girl in school, somehow you were different?
Oh, very early on. There was a rumor floating around our synagogue in Chicago that my mother had been raped by a black man.
Oh, my God.
And that basically she and my father, you know, wanted a child so much that they decided to keep the baby. But that's why I, quote, look this way. And I was probably 6 or 7 when I heard it for the first time. And I went home from Shabbaton and asked my parents what rape meant.
Mm.
So I was young. I was too young.
We will talk much more with Mara Begad about her new book, The Color of Love, which is a very interesting book, and her own experiences as a mixed-race Jewish woman, no longer a girl, when we come back in just a moment here on Too Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. Or visit our website at too2jewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts. We welcome back our randomly occurring feature of Too Jewish, Zen Judaism, haikus for Jews, koans of wisdom about our journey. Wet moss on the old stones, lying in the grass, I ponder who to sue. And the Shiva visit, so sorry about your loss. Now, back to my problems. That was Zen Judaism, haikus for Jews, two koans of wisdom, here on Too Jewish. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Tom, you served in the State Department for a long time. There must be times as a diplomat where diplomacy is required, especially a Jewish guy in a variety of interesting places. Can you share a story or two about that?
Sure. I mean, one of the things that I loved about being a diplomat is every day hit you with new surprises and new challenges, both large and small. But you had to remind yourself sometimes that what your job was really about was pikuach nefesh, saving lives, preventing wars, de-escalating conflicts, all that kind of stuff. So fortunately, there is a Talmudic principle, which you know well, Pikuach nefesh dochet kulam. The saving a life is more important than anything. So, you know, you can violate Shabbos. If somebody's suicidal and you need to call a counselor, doesn't matter if it's Shabbos or a major holiday, you save the life. And it's very clear cut.
Absolutely.
So that enables Orthodox Jews to serve as diplomats and eventually as ambassadors because they're fully aware that so much of what they do is either directly or indirectly involved in pikuach nefesh. So you kind of roll with the punches, but there are situations. I mean, I used to observe the Jewish dietary laws much more strictly than I do now. And I learned the hard way that if you tell a host or hostess, especially in the diplomatic community, that you're kosher, they will look up lists of kosher foods and they will not serve you pig or shellfish. But they might serve you chicken parmesan. So neither the chicken is kosher, nor the fact that the meat is mixed with the milk is kosher. And you're in an awkward situation because they went out of their way to make something that, to the best of their knowledge, is kosher. So you know, just on a simple level, so what do you do? I mean, it's not a tragedy if you don't eat, but it's kind of a slap in the face to say, no, 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 this may be kosher by your lights, but it's not kosher enough for me. There are Jews who will do that. I'm not one of them. But then there were, you know, there were other moments where you wondered if it was safe to sort of proclaim your Jewishness. I mean, in a certain sense, I'm lucky with a name like Thomas Price.
I when you came to town, I had no idea you were Jewish for like the first year. It was like, so what? Some state department guy named Tom Price moved to Tucson. Why is he talking about Jewish stuff?
Right. Well, so I'm sure I've told you this story before, but one of the best examples of this doesn't really involve being Jewish so much as it involves Jewish sensitivities. And the very first time I met with the Taliban leadership, Mullah Omar, Mullah Muhammad, whatever, all these guys, they're sitting on a couch at a coffee table, and this is the classic setup for a Central Asian meeting in about six different countries in the region, maybe 10. The visitors are on one side, the home team's on the other side, there's a coffee table between you, and on the coffee table are always white raisins, black raisins, dried apricots, walnuts, pistachios, and little bowls of green tea. So when we sat down with an interpreter on both sides, they gestured to me to help myself, and I said, well, I want to thank you very much for your hospitality and for sharing God's bounty with us. My version of a sort of universalistic motzi, if you will. So this was interpreted, and it caused an outburst, an explosion of consternation and surprise and shock, and I feared anger. So I said to my interpreter, I said, did I make them angry? He said, no, no, on the contrary. You said something very good. And they're shocked because they always believe that Americans were infidels and don't believe in God. Fact that you said this in such an appropriate context, they probably think you're actually a Muslim. So there you go.
Great successes in American diplomacy.
Absolutely.
Tom, thanks so much. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. One morning, Rabbi Rabinowitz goes to visit his congregant, Samuel. Shalom, Sam. I'll come straight to the point. I've come because our synagogue needs your help. You've been a member over 20 years. You're always quick to pay your membership fees in full, but as you are aware, we are in a financial crisis. I've come to ask you for a little extra for the new school building fund. How much are you looking to get from me? How big is a little? Asks Sam. I'll be honest, $50,000 would be a tremendous help to us, replies the rabbi. Sam responds, Rabbi, my daughter Rebecca is getting married soon. She asked me for $100,000 to help her buy that house in the suburbs. My son David is starting at the university. He wants $75,000 just for his first year there. My wife Sadie wants a hysterectomy. She asked for $50,000 for doctor's fees and hospitalization. And that's not all. You know from your own experience that to keep my mother in a Jewish nursing home, they get $90,000. So, Rabbi, if I can say no to all of them, I can say no to you. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you, you should live, and of course, be well. And now a word of Torah. This week, our portion features drama and tragedy, rebellion and punishment. To recap last week's events, the people of Israel come to the borders of the Promised Land just a couple of years after leaving Egyptian slavery. But a team of spies comes back with a poor report. We're not strong enough to conquer the land. Shocked, the Israelites rebel against the leadership of Moses and Aaron. That rebellion fails and a disastrous verdict is proclaimed. A lack of faith in God is the heart of the problem. And God decides this generation can never come into the Holy Land and will have to live in the Sinai until they all die off. Only then can a new generation, fresh with the optimism of youth, untainted by slavery and its mentality, come forward into the Promised Land. Stung by this sentence of death in the desert at the start of this week's portion, a group of rebels under the leadership of a priest, a Levite named Korach, challenges the control of Moses and Aaron. Korach accuses his fellow Levites, Moses and Aaron, of chutzpah, of hubris, overweening pride and egotism. Born into the same tribe, Korach is an insider rebelling against his own kin. Who are these guys, Moses and Aaron, to take on the authority of ruling over us? His rebellion threatens the very foundations of Israelite leadership. For if the God of liberation is not at the heart of this enterprise, if it's all a matter of personal ego and self-aggrandizement, they might as well go back to Egypt and live in slavery. And some propose now to do just that. But Korach dissembles. That is, he lies. Moses clearly has had no great desire for this high office. He has held it as a sacred trust given to him by God. Korach is threatening God's authority, not Moses. To determine the ongoing leadership of Israel, a great outdoor contest is held, a kind of religious challenge match. The net result is that Korach and his followers are completely destroyed, while Moses and Aaron are fully vindicated. It's nice when God has your back in these deals, isn't it? One lesson of Korach is that before we accuse others of arrogance, we need to look in the mirror. The more abiding lesson is that a Judaism that doesn't base itself in humility and reverence for God, and which is focused on personal aggrandizement, will fail. Only through faith and devotion can we reach our own promised land. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Mara B. Gad, author of the new book, The Color of Love, Diary of a Mixed-Race Jewish Girl, will share what happened to her at the very liberal Union for Reform Judaism biennial convention last fall, and what it should tell each of us about the need to explore our own racism. Find out all about it when we come back in To Jewish in just a moment.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Amy Acton, the Jewish Department of Health director in Ohio, who came under fire for the stay-at-home orders to stem the coronavirus crisis, including armed protesters carrying signs with anti-Semitic messages, has resigned. Acton, whose resignation was official last week, will become the chief health advisor to Ohio Governor Mike DeWine. Since the start of the coronavirus pandemic, Acton was compared to the Nazis for supporting a reopening plan that included issuing certificates of immunity to businesses, and called a globalist for extending stay-at-home orders in May. Last month, the state's House of Representatives passed legislation to limit Acton's powers. Ohio began lifting coronavirus restrictions in stages on May 4th. Protesters gathered in front of her Columbus-area home on weekends, some carrying guns and shouting slogans, or carrying signs bearing anti-Semitic, sexist rhetoric. While I'm pleased that Dr. Acton will continue to advise Governor DeWine on health issues, I can't help but be disappointed by her resignation as health director, Kenny Yuko, the state Senate's minority leader, a Democrat, said. She endured an incredible amount of unfair criticism, including anti-Semitic attacks. All those who have insulted, harassed, or threatened her and her family should be ashamed. In more positive news, correcting an injustice that's been ongoing for 80 years, last week, Portugal finally granted official recognition to the heroism of Consul Aristides de Sousa Mendes. De Sousa Mendes' courageous issuing of diplomatic passes to as many as 20,000 refugees fleeing the Nazis through Bordeaux, France, saved many Jewish lives, as well as many others, in the chaotic days of June 1940. The story goes like this. De Sousa Mendes was Portugal's consul in southern France near the Spanish border during the short, disastrous Battle of France in June 1940, 80 years ago this month. As the Nazis shockingly whipped the French in a classic blitzkrieg, thousands and thousands of Jews and others fled towards Spain, which was fascist but remained neutral throughout World War II. If they could cross the Pyrenees into Spain or go on to also neutral Portugal, These refugees could survive Hitler's conquest and the subsequent Holocaust. But in order to cross into Spain, a diplomatic document from a country friendly to Spain was required. Portugal, under the command of the fascist dictator Antonio de Oliveira Salazar, was such a country. And Bordeaux was where a drama played out. De Sousa Mendes was presented with a dilemma. He was from a wealthy family, a successful career diplomat in good graces with the dictator Salazar. If he suddenly issued thousands of transit passes, he would be violating his own nation's neutrality and friendship with both Franco, the Spanish fascist dictator, and Hitler, Germany's ascendant Führer, the rising master of Europe. Portugal's diplomatic corps was under strict instructions from the right-wing Salazar dictatorship that visas should be issued to refugee Jews and stateless people only with the express permission from Lisbon, the capital. That was very unlikely to come at all, and certainly not before the refugees before him were captured by fascists. If de Sousa Mendes did not act, the many thousands of Jews, liberals, and intellectuals would be taken by the Nazis or the puppet Vichy regime and sent to their likely deaths. In Bordeaux, the consul de Sousa Mendes had struck up a friendship with a rabbi. Rabbi Chaim Kruger fled the Nazi advance from his home in Belgium. Consul de Sousa Mendes liked him, offered the rabbi and his immediate family safe passage across the Spanish border, and then encountered a moral crisis. Rabbi Kruger refused the offer, as he could not abandon the thousands of Jewish refugees in Bordeaux. In a letter dated 13 June 1940, de Sousa Mendes wrote, "Situation here is horrible. I am in bed because of a strong nervous breakdown." Whatever went through the troubled diplomat's mind, de Sousa Mendes emerged on June 17, 1940, with a new determination. According to his son, Pedro Nuno de Sousa Mendes, he strode out of his bedroom, flung open the door of the chancellery, and announced in a loud voice, "From now on, I'm giving everyone visas. There'll be no more nationalities, races, or religions." He knew there would be a cost to his career, his family, and his life, but he chose emphatically to do the right thing, the courageous thing. Later on in Lisbon, de Sousa Mendes told a rabbi, "If so many Jews can suffer because of one Catholic, it's all right for one Catholic to suffer for so many Jews." And so in the weeks that followed, de Sousa Mendes became the lifeline, saving many Jews and others. No one knows for sure how many transit visas he issued, allowing refugees to pass from France into Spain and travel onward to Portugal. Estimates range between 10,000 and 30,000. Celebrities were among those he saved. Among the people who escaped occupied France thanks to de Sousa Mendes' visas were surrealist artist Salvador Dalí, filmmaker King Vidor, members of the Rothschild banking family, and the majority of Belgium's future government in exile. At one point, de Sousa Mendes literally sat in the road writing diplomatic passes industrial style for Jewish and other families who clamored desperately for these lifelines. The dictator Salazar did not take kindly to disobedience from his diplomats. De Sousa Mendes was recalled, expelled from the diplomatic corps, charged with crimes, and had his reputation ruined. Salazar's Portugal would later be praised for its role allowing refugees to escape from Nazi occupation and repression. But de Sousa Mendes was left without work or the possibility of income. His family home in Cabanas de Viriato fell into ruin. He was reduced to getting food from a soup kitchen run by Lisbon's Jewish community. Sousa Mendes was badly mistreated by Salazar and died in 1954 in misery as a pauper. His children emigrated to try to find a future somewhere else. In 1966, Israel recognized him at Yad Vashem as a righteous Gentile, but it wasn't until 1988 that the Portuguese parliament finally withdrew diplomatic charges against him posthumously. And it is only now, in June 2020, 66 years after his death, that Portugal has finally granted official recognition to its disobedient diplomat, Aristides de Sousa Mendes, as a hero. The parliament has decided a monument in the national pantheon will bear his name. It is very late, but this recognition of a true moral hero of the Holocaust, who saved the lives of so many Jews at the cost of his own future, is well taken. May his memory be a blessing. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Mara B. God, is the author of the new book, The Color of Love, Diary of a Mixed-Race Jewish Girl. All right, I called you a woman instead of a girl, and you joked about that. Boy, do labels matter now, don't they?
Yes, people are claiming their labels in ways that I certainly never considered, in some ways that are uncomfortable for me personally. Labeling other people proactively, which I think can be challenging. So yes, it is definitely, we live at a time where labels are widely being used in ways that we must pay attention to.
Yes, very closely. In your book, you talk about your relative Nettie, who plays a huge part. She's nearly the protagonist at times.
Well, I would offer that I'm always the protagonist.
Well, okay, sorry. Yeah, she plays a big part in this book, though, both for your efforts to win her approval and her racism, which manifests itself in a variety of times, including you begin the book nearly with, you know, sort of the worst way at the worst possible time. And then you ended up taking on responsibility for her in her later stages of life. How did you find it in yourself to overcome her incredibly racist responses to you?
You know, it's a very interesting question. I think for all of us, there are these people that end up in our path that offer us a remarkable opportunity to figure out who we are as people. And when there was this moment where I had to decide if I was going to behave in a vengeful way and leave someone who was sick and in a great deal of trouble to essentially die a terrible death, or act, for me, there was no choice to be made. I am not a vengeful person. I don't believe God built us to be vengeful. My parents did not raise me to be vengeful. I believe that when people who are racist and intolerant push us to a place where we then behave in ways that are not loving, that are vengeful, that are less than who we really are, then hate wins. And so for me, there was no choice to be made. I did it for my mother to have peace of mind. This particular family member at one point had been like a surrogate parent to my mother in many ways. I wanted my mother to have that. And I did it because at the end of the day, I could not imagine who I would be had I left her to suffer.
So I want to complete the picture a little bit. This woman, Nettie, who was, I guess, a cousin, aunt, I don't know the right
exact. A great aunt, sorry.
Had treated your siblings much more generously than she ever treated you. At your sister's wedding, you know, she said, just as you were preparing to sing, as your sister came down the aisle, she said something horrible to you and racist. When you went and visited her and her husband wanted to get you a gift because that was very common, she refused to let him buy it for you and insisted that you go home and get a leftover. I mean, just a whole shit. Not because she didn't like your family, but because you were half black, right?
And just so that your listeners are aware, not that I want to give too much away, because of course I want people to read the book.
Yeah, I don't want to give away the whole book, sorry.
I do have two siblings that were biological to my parents after they adopted me. So I have two siblings that are, you know, as Ashkenazi as can be. And I was born to a white Jewish woman who had had an affair with a black man in the late 60s. And so, you know, I was adopted through a rabbi in New York, and that's sort of how we ended up being a family.
What I wanted to add was, I mean, you know, just to give that context, that's overcoming not, you know, some casual racism along the street, not some relative that you never have to see again, but somebody really important in your growing up and at these crucial moments of your life. How did writing The Color of Love change you?
You know, I used to be a professional musical theater actress back in the very early 90s. And so...
By the way, that's a really tough business.
It's a very tough business. And I will add that being biracial did not help me in the early 90s. You know, doing mixed race casting was not something that happened back then. Nobody was putting me in the chorus of Oklahoma on Broadway in 1992.
Right.
They would today.
Yeah.
Back then, it, you know, the color of my skin did not help. But back then, when I was put forth on stage and out in the public, I was doing it as someone else. Writing this book and certainly being out on book tour and even doing things like this, being on a podcast, I'm out in the world as myself, unfurled, speaking the truth about what it is for those of us that the world deems other, right? We live in a world that still labors under the misconception that Black people are Muslim or Christian and Jews are white. And there are so many of us that defy that. And for me to now be out in the world solely as myself with my voice unfurled has been the most profound, the most terrifying, the most empowering thing that I think I've ever done.
You know, I have to say it's a little bit stunning to me. Yeah, I guess it's just naivety. In my previous congregation, I remember doing we always had all the pre-bar bat mitzvah kids come up and help lead services, and we didn't have a bar bat mitzvah. Remember one Shabbat where we had a half Japanese girl, a Korean girl who'd been adopted, a Vietnamese girl who'd been adopted, an African American boy, half African American boy whose mom was Jewish, you know, and then one kid whose both parents had converted. And so none of them look like your typical Jewish kid, if there is such a thing. And I thought, like, man, that's Judaism in the early 2000s. You know, it was so great. It's a little stunning for me to realize how much of that racism is still left floating around, even in the reform world. Is that just naive on my part?
I would have to say that it is. And I don't mean that in any insulting way. You are not the only person who not only hopes or believes that we have come so far, but we don't want to believe that this is a problem that we have. Nobody, even David Duke, right? David Duke, who is absolutely, without question, the prototype of what a racist is, doesn't call himself a racist. He refers to himself as a proud white nationalist.
And that's been true for 40 years, actually. You know, you look at the movie Black Klansman, it highlights that.
That's right. Nobody wants to actually claim that. And certainly communities of people that hold themselves up as being, quote, progressive, don't want to think. And I think that's one of the great traps that progressive organizations, progressive people fall into. It's happening somewhere else. We're not doing this. We don't do this. Other people do that.
So I'm going to ask you about a difficult question. You recently spoke at the Union for Reform Judaism Biennial, which was held in Chicago not too long ago, and your experiences there were not what anybody could have hoped for. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. I struggled with exactly what we're talking about from the moment that I arrived, even with a neon orange presenter badge that I had to really work hard to get, because the person behind the desk questioned if I was the real Mara Gad.
Oh,
when
my goodness.
I walked up to the desk, people pointed, people whispered, talking about me like I wasn't even there, wondering what I was doing there. People assumed me to be the hotel staff with the orange presenter badge on, and told me they wanted their room service faster. These same people, mind you, were in the plenary room wildly supporting and applauding a slavery reparations bill that the URJ passed. And so my biennial experience was in many ways devastating for me, but in many ways exactly the perfect illustration of why this conversation must happen. To your point, we are a beautifully diverse community, getting more and more diverse every day. If we don't figure out how to treat one another simply as human beings, all worthy of the same level of respect, what are we?
Do you think some of this is just generational?
You know, it's very interesting. I get asked that all the time. Oh. And the answer is no, I don't. Because the person behind the desk with the name badges was in their early 20s. I believe that intolerance, that racism, I actually believe ignorance is a choice that human beings make, no matter how old they are, how young they are. It's a choice. And it is not something that we can simply push off on generations from another time. Some of the older generations are, quite frankly, some of my biggest advocates. So no, I don't.
In a way, it makes me feel like we've failed with our educational system for younger people. I mean, I'm around your age, and I think about, you're right, like some of the older people, not all, of course, but some of the older people are very vocal and understand the fight that was necessary to get African-American rights in this country, which are still far from guaranteed. I think the younger people just take it for granted and then just kind of let these prejudices creep in. I used to say, you know, ignorance is not hostility, ignorance is not hate, but tell us a little bit about how ignorance is a choice.
In an age where we are constantly surrounded by and often holding devices that give us access to every particular kind of information we could possibly want, for people in 2020 to cry ignorance is a choice. Plain and simple. And there are plenty of people that cling to that. And that too is a choice. But we live at a time where you can get information about anything that you want at any time. Maybe you don't want to know. And, I tell people this all the time. I do believe that there is this commitment. I believe that the reform movement is committed to it. I believe that. Listen, I know that the conservative movement, the Orthodox movement, I have a number of wonderful supporters across every denomination of Judaism. And people come to me and they say, Mara, what can we do? What? Give us the list of things we can do to make our synagogue, our community, more welcoming. And I say to them, if there were a checklist, you think we'd still be having this problem? But what I believe all of us, myself included, it starts with individuals. And if each of us takes 15 minutes, 20 minutes by ourselves, like we're supposed to, you know, in the days between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, to do an inventory, to say, how can I do better? How can I be better around this? My behavior first. Because at the end of the day, you can teach, you can have rules about how you're supposed to greet people all you want. If somebody's bias kicks up, it kicks up because they don't believe they have it.
I'm going to throw in a kind of confessional. I've always thought that the right way to respond to any of these kinds of things, whether these kinds of things, probably the wrong way to phrase it, but the right way to respond to the kind of bigotry that's so automatic and human, as you note, probably the very earliest human emotion after I'm connected to this clan is those guys are different, they're less than we are.
Mm-hmm.
It is to ignore it. I never believed in having Rainbow Coalition Shabbat. We just always welcomed gays, lesbians, transsexuals, everybody equally. Everybody was a member because they were there and they were there for Judaism, whether they were Jewish or not even. And I felt the same way about all the variety of races and backgrounds and nationalities. Is that not the right way to approach this?
Right way, wrong way. It's everybody wants and needs something different in terms of all of those things, right? What I do know is that making sure that our spaces are welcoming, that our communities' leadership reflect the diversity of our community helps. I believe that actions speak louder than words. And so if people
Absolutely.
Feel welcome in your congregation, it isn't because you put on your website, we're a diverse community. It's
right.
because the people in your community leave others feeling welcome. Do I believe we need to support one another and celebrate one another and raise one another up? Yes, absolutely, as human beings. But there is a space where, you know, are you doing it because it's what's in your heart? Are you doing it because it's what you think you have to do in 2020? you know, there's a space where unless it's genuine, it's not going to work anyway. That's what I was getting at, this whole notion of large gestures fall flat when it's not resonant for individuals. Does that...
No, I think that's exactly right. It's, you know, and after all, look, that's Judaism. It's Loha Midrash Haikari Allah Hamasa. It's not the story that matters. It's not the talking that matters. It's the actions.
Yeah, like people say all the time, people talk and talk. I support you. Okay, yeah. How are you doing that?
Yeah, exactly.
I want to thank Mara B. Gad. I feel like we go on for a long time on this subject, but we're out of time. I want to thank Mara B. Gad for a great visit here on Too Jewish. The book is called The Color of Love. Where can people go to find out more about you, to find out more about the book?
The book is available at independent bookstores, which I appreciate. Some are open, some are not. Certainly on their websites. If you have a favorite independent bookstore, it's also widely available on Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com. And most people... find me on Facebook, and I'm Mara with two R's, so M-A-R-R-A, Gad, G-A-D. I think that's probably the easiest path.
Thank you so much, Mara. It's a great pleasure. When we come back at Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Our playout this morning comes from Dame Vera Lynn, the British singer who passed away last week at the age of 103. She was married to a Jewish musician named Harry Lewis and performed many benefit concerts for Jewish refugees during World War II. This is her signature hit, We'll Meet Again. We will. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be our good friend Oshrat Barel, longtime Avinah on Israel for Too Jewish, speaking to us from Israel about the lockdown and quarantine in Israel, Israeli politics, and much more. My friends, may you have a healthy week. God willing, a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
We'll meet again. Don't know where. Don't know when. But I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know? Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. We'll meet again, don't know where. Don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.
Yeah. sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.